യോഗേന ചിത്തസ്യ പദേന വാചാം മലം ശരീരശ്ച ച വൈദികേന യോപാകരോത്തം പ്രവരം മുനീനാം പതഞ്ജലിം പ്രാഞ്ജലിരാനതോസ്മി. So after a short interval, we are now coming back to the Patanjali Yoga Sutras. So far we have discussed some of the most important principles in the yoga system, and also in the yoga psychology. First, Patanjali makes it clear that we turn to yoga when we feel that we are not satisfied, we are not fully contented with what we experience in our everyday life, with what we feel, what we enjoy through the five senses of perception and mind. When we reach a point that all the empirical things together cannot give us ultimate peace of mind, cannot answer the question, why we are here, why we behave the way we behave, what is the mystery of life and death, all these questions make us turn the question to ourselves, who am I, what's my true nature, what's the meaning and significance of life. So that's why Atha Yoga Anvishasana. When we reach this state, that's the meaning, Atha. When we reach such a state, then we start discussion or interpretation of yoga. The second sutra clearly defines what yoga is all about. Yogaha Chitta Vritti Nirodhaha. Now, yoga is defined as the cessation of our sense of self, our own personality, our own concept of what we are, misidentifying with all these peripheral transitory objects that we experience. When something happens, we become unhappy because we identify ourselves with that something. Here, an interesting discussion is sometimes made by psychologists who read yoga. A very interesting discussion. I'm turning your attention to that point, then we will come to the text. What's the meaning of cessation? Yoga is defined here as cessation of our misidentification with different objects, impressions, tendencies that emerge in the mind, misidentification with objects. Normally, as I said, when we see an object, a visual object, for the time being, we identify ourselves as the seer of that object. When we feel pain or when we have an unhappy incident, even in our life, something that gives us pain, we identify ourselves as a psychophysical mechanism who is going through, who is undergoing this unfortunate, painful experience. So how we interpret ourselves? To be a tiny psychophysical mechanism who could be affected by a most insignificant, fluctuating, transitory experience. In Buddhist tradition, they concentrate on the momentariness. They focus on the fact that all these experiences are momentary. They are not eternal. That is true. To be, just I shall give a short little background of yoga and its connection with Buddhist philosophy. One of the four schools of later Buddhism is known as Vijnanavada, or subjective idealism. Sometimes it is called Yogacara. In fact, many of the most fundamental canonical works were looking upon the Vijnanavada system as Yogacara, because these Buddhists were practitioners of yoga. They got many of these ideas from Patanjali's system. So that's called Yogacara, those who practice yoga. In fact, the two schools of Mahayana Buddhism, which are very popular in this country today, one is the doctrine of emptiness, which is known as Shunyavada. The other is the doctrine of subjective idealism, which is called Vijnanavada, sometimes called Yogacara system. Its real name was Yogacara, because one of its most famous book is Yogacara Bhumi. That's a famous, one of the most famous book of this Vijnanavada Yogacara system. Now, they focused on one simple, important fact of empirical experiences. What is this? It is momentary. Everything is changing. Everything is in a flux. Nothing is permanent. If we can concentrate on the impermanence of the empirical phenomena, we can enjoy peace, we can have peace of mind. Because peace of mind is lost when we identify an object to be something eternal, to be permanent, instead of recognizing its impermanence. By mistake, we read permanence into it. To give an example, suppose something, say a collapse in the markets, or the death of a near dear one. All this happened. Or maybe one may lose his job, or may not get promotion. All these things, or maybe in a state of perpetual unemployment. That also is a possibility. In all these conditions, we lose our peace of mind. Because we think that state is a permanent state, which even from a point of view of geology or physics cannot be possible. Everything is in a flux, including the universe. So, but then what happens when we are living through that experience, when we experience that and that painful situation, for the time being we forget that it is a passing stage, but we start thinking it is a permanent situation. It is this identification that makes us painful. And what is the difference between a philosopher and layman? A philosopher also goes through all these problems. Every human being has to go through certain fundamental laws of the five elements. Death, disease, and all the other related experiences of life in this world are common for an Aristotle and also for a very common ordinary individual, for an illiterate person. The same. What's the difference between a philosopher and an ordinary man? An ordinary man, for the time being, thinks this is a permanent state and he loses his mind. He collapses mentally, physically. His BP goes up. But a philosopher, he also faces the same problem. His BP doesn't go up. His diabetes may not be aggravated by this stock, the collapse of the stock market. Because he understands, while going through this experience, he also understands this is not going to be a permanent state of affairs. That's the main philosopher. That's the main difference between a philosopher and a layman. And incidentally, coming to the subject, most of you have read Bhagavad Gita. And you also know the great teacher who preached Bhagavad Gita. His name was Lord Sri Krishna. The classical work which expounds his life and teachings was written around 7th century AD. It's called Srimad Bhagavata Purana, with 12 chapters, 12 sections. 12 sections, each section having different chapters. Nearly 18,000 verses. Very complicated Sanskrit work from a literary point of view, using all kinds of complex meters and Sanskrit meters. Now, there Lord Krishna is defined as a supreme philosopher, the greatest philosopher in the world. And you know the reason, because he never laughed and he never cried. He never wept and he never became jubilant. He was not a piece of stone or a dead wall. He was a living mechanism. He played the role of a soldier, a statesman, a negotiator, an emissary, and a great Samaritan who went about healing the diseases of common people, giving protection to the weak and the unprotected, the downtrodden, the children, the sages and saints. That was his main job, mostly helping people in distress. But one speciality of this man was he never hesitated. And he never avoided doing his appointed duty and responsibility. He was always active, but he never doubted, never wept, never cried, never hesitated, but he was never too happy either. And for that reason, he was never unhappy. So, Krishnastu Bhagavan Swayam, that is the Bhagavata statement. Lord, this Krishna was Lord himself. The explanation given by one of the Tikakaras is this. Every moment of his life, he could see the past, present and future simultaneously. Now, if you can see your future, sometimes it could make you terribly angry or terribly unhappy. If in many cases, it's better that we don't know what is going to happen tomorrow. If you look back and think, suppose you have gone through many difficult times, difficult periods, difficult experiences during your 20s. But if you knew when you were a 10-year-old boy, a girl for that matter, that you were going to experience all this, probably you would have crushed, you would have been crushed, you would have become terribly upset. You won't be able to face the problems. So it's better that we don't know what is going to happen. And also, it's good that we forget what has happened. In fact, you'll find in the same Gita, there is a statement, Matta Smriti Jnanam Apohanam Cha. It's a famous statement. It is memory, the gift of remembering things and the gift of forgetting things. Memory and forgetfulness, both are gifts from God. If we can't forget things, we'll go mad. If we can't remember things, then also we'll go mad. So, the point is this. Krishna was a special person. So, he's defined as a supreme philosopher. Because he could see the past, present and future in one dimension. So, if there was a painful experience, he knew it will pass off. So there was no need to be upset. And if there was something wonderful happening, there is no need to be too happy, because that happy situation won't continue for long. So perpetual realization of the momentariness of the world, empirical experiences, is one way to get peace of mind. That was the path of Yogacara philosophers or Vijnanavada philosophers. But Lord Krishna's method was little different. While he recognized the transitoriness, the impermanence of empirical experiences, he also recognized the permanence of something that goes beyond empirical. Something that is trans-empirical, that goes beyond the empirical, beyond the present, beyond today, beyond this moment, that exists for all times. So that which is momentary is relative, but behind and beyond this momentary, there is the permanent, non-momentary, absolute reality, Atman. That's the main difference between Yogacara system and Vedanta. Vedanta posits a permanent, absolute, eternal, unchanging reality behind and beyond all these empirical relative things. Both yoga and Vedanta try to remind us that we are, in fact, that eternal absolute reality. So we need not be upset by unhappy experiences, and there is no room to be too happy when something good happens in front of us. Now, so far we have discussed different vrittis, 5 vrittaya panchatayaha, klishtaha aklishtaha, one sutra says. Vrittis are 5 nature. They are sometimes very happy, they are sometimes painful, sometimes not painful. So whatever we do, whatever we experience creates a tendency in our mind. That residual factor is called a vritti or tendency. That tendency can become a potent characteristic, which is called samskara. Samskara can become a vasana. Vasana can make us repeat the same action. And that action could again produce a byproduct, a vritti, a tendency, which again becomes samskara. So I shall draw this cycle and then come to the subject, because a little background information is necessary before coming to the, I think today we had to deal with perhaps the 17th sutra of the first chapter, that is Samadhipada. So Patanjali says there are 5 types of vrittis: pramana, viparyaya, vikalpa, nidra, smritayaha. These are the 5 vrittis. Certain vrittis, tendencies, are based on valid experiences. Some of them are based on verbal testimony, reading books, different scriptures. And then certain vrittis may be just ideas and delusions without a corresponding object. See, even if you get a delusion, misunderstanding, that also creates a vritti. As I said earlier, whatever we do consciously produces its byproducts. It's called vritti. It's called a modification in our mind. That what we cannot do anything without this modification being produced simultaneously. Now, it need not be a deliberate conscious action. It could be a flashing thought in our mind without any corresponding object, which is called vikalpa. It can be just a memory coming back to the mind. It can be something related to our experience in dream. All these create a kind of modification in our mind stuff. These modifications, when they get concentrated, they become a strong tendency which wants to express itself in different circumstances. A person who has done something in the past, has thought a thought, had dreamed something, may have read something, remembered something, all these will create some kind of a modification in the mind. This any modern psychologist will accept it, all of them. In fact, the mistake that Freud made was he accepted this, but he started walking in the dark. He reduced human mechanism to the lowest possible conceivable entity. That's all. But Jung and Adler, both of them accepted many of the ideas which Patanjali states here, the types and archetypes, all these complexes and all that. Now, again, coming back. So, as I said, every action, thought, memory, or anything could produce a modification. Modification is called a vritti. It could become a samskara, a strong, potent tendency, potentiality. That is samskara. If you had done something, there's always a tendency, a possibility that you may repeat that action sometime in future, because it comes to the surface. When we have done something long in the past, maybe according to Vedanta, say 2,000 years, maybe about 90 lives earlier, you may have done something nice, something good. You meditated, you are a saint, you are an ascetic. Today, if we go through a meditation center, that tendency in the form of samskara may tell us, let's go and sit for some time. 2,000 years must have gone through, but still, if that samskara is strong, it will force us to move in that direction. So action, modification, then samskara. Karma, vritti, samskara. Action, modification, then potentiality or tendency. Fourth stage is this tendency, samskara, can become a vasana. What is vasana? Vasana is a natural movement of this tendency towards an action. Sometimes, you know, when children go for classical music, some great classical music, I'm talking about classical music, mind you. The other thing could be practiced by anybody. It may not require much previous tendencies. But I'm talking about classical music. Some great musicians will tell the student, well, you have a vasana, means you have practiced this sometime in the past, which has become a potential tendency. So that tendency has a strong, that culture has a strong tendency to repeat the same action again, so that person may show great genius in picking up a music, perhaps some song or something. Vasana. Now, vasana becomes a sankalpa. Well, I'm going to do that. And once you take a decision, you do that. And when you do it, again what happens? The already accumulated tendencies are strengthened by repeated actions. So these vrittis can be divided into five categories. That is, pramana, viparya, vikalpa, nidra, smritayaka. And the purpose of yoga is to stop ourselves misidentifying with all these vrittis, tendencies, by going beyond them. That's the purpose. And for that, we have to practice strong non-attachment, the detached param vairagya, that's a term used here. This should be practiced again and again. We must think of the impermanence of these external objects and experiences, and that will help us to detach ourselves from these experiences, objects which come and go, which emerge like waves in the ocean, recognizing their impermanence. And this will gradually take us to the state of the first stage in samadhi, which is called samprajnada samadhi. Samadhi, this is the first stage. Samprajnada samadhi and asamprajnada samadhi. These are two types of samadhis. That's what we are going to take up today. Now, I'm going to read the 17th sutra here, vitarka vichara ananda asmita anugama samprajnataha. This is the sutra, that is 17, those who have got the book. So, this samadhi, samadhi actually means a great single prajna vritti. So, there are innumerable millions of modifications in our mind stuff, which, as I said earlier, as I compared earlier, can be called a lake, a mind lake, or a bundle. It's a bundle or it's a lake. A lake with different layers of conflicting, contradictory tendencies, impressions, and characteristics, etc. Or a bundle, which has got all kinds of tendencies. Some of them are good, some of them are not good. Two types, the good and the bad. Klishta, aklishta, according to Patanjali. Now, all these tendencies vanish and they become one great modification, tendency. That is called prajñāvṛtti. Now, the first stage, the first step towards reaching samadhi state is to get rid of all these innumerable millions and millions of contradictory and mutually conflicting tendencies and impressions and modifications, and then come to one single great tendency, modification, which is called prajñāvṛtti. This is the first step. Once you reach that step, then you reach some prajñāda samādhi. This is that's defined in the 17th sutra. Now I shall explain the words. So, vitarka, vichara, ananda, asmita. The four words used here. Vitarka is nothing but gross objects, modifications related to gross objects that we pursue, that we see, that we cognize, the cognized, the perceived, the seen. In Sanskrit is called grahya. When you see an object, the object that is perceived, that is objectified, is called grahya. You are called grahaka, the perceiver, the seer, the subject. And the process of that perception is called grahanam. These are three important terms that are used. You don't find them in Patanjali Sutras, but these are the terms that are used in the commentaries on the sutras, like Vyasa and Vijnana Bhikshu and other commentaries. So first you have to remember this. Grahya, grahana, and grihida. The one who perceives, the one who sees, the one who cognizes the subject is grihita. And grahya is what is perceived, objectified, known. And grahanam is the process of knowing, perceiving, cognizing, etc. Now, at one stage, the most primitive stage, what happens? We reach a state of samadhi, which is accompanied by tendencies, etc., related to gross objects. Means we concentrate on a gross object. Samadhi is concentration. When we concentrate on a gross object, it is called the first state of samadhi. So people can concentrate on anything which is subtle, which is grand, beautiful, sublime, which is gross, mind you. That's the first step. And the next stage, you can concentrate on something which is subtle, but also grand, sublime. That's why the first stage, a person who practices samadhi should be able to concentrate on something which is edifying, which is sublime, which is grand, which has got some universal spiritual dimension. So that's why the picture of a saint, the sky, the beautiful nature, or even a symbol, any of these can become an object of a focus of concentration to begin with. But of course, we must remember one important principle. As I mentioned earlier, samadhi is the last state. Patanjali system, Patanjali Yoga Sutra structure is a bit bizarre, but I want to explain this at this stage. Patanjali Yoga Sutras are given in four chapters. Samadhipada, Sadhanapada, Vibhudipada, and Kaivalyapada. This is the structure of the book. For some mysterious reason, he begins with a description of concentration or samadhi. That's how it happens in ancient work, mind you. Most probably, Patanjali must have lived around 1400 BC, and these suttas were not written, they were taught by students, by Patanjali students to their students and like that, through the teacher-student succession tradition, it continued orally, not through written form. So, somehow, this was how the original sutra structure was published for the first time when they were published in written form, in printed letters. So, the first chapter deals with the ultimate goal of spiritual life, samadhi. In fact, the second chapter deals with the means. Sadhana means means. And there you find a long description of different important characteristics, qualities, qualifications that we must acquire before we start practicing yoga. So at this stage, I must turn your attention to the second chapter of Patanjali's Yoga Sutra. It's called Sadhana Pada, which means means. So the means are described, the path are described in the second chapter. And ultimate goal, Samadhi, total, the complete concentration is described in the first chapter. Means are described in the second chapter. The results of yoga practices, like different supernatural powers, powers of mind, you know, when we can control the mind, mind can produce many, many inconceivable, unimaginable powers, which we call, sometimes we call, wrongly, we call them supernatural powers. But Patanjali doesn't call them supernatural. He calls them natural powers. That's why Patanjali's system is considered to be scientific. The moment you talk about supernatural, then there is something wrong in that analysis. So Patanjali doesn't call them supernatural powers. Though in the translations, for want of better terms, terminology, the translators may have used the word supernatural powers. Supernatural in the sense, it is supernatural for those who do not practice yoga, but very natural for those who practice it. See, even the physical level, you can imagine what all apparently supernatural powers people obtain by constant practice of the body. Long jumpers, high jumpers, if you read the newspaper reports during the Olympics or World Cup, you can see that. These are supernatural powers for the common man, but not for those who practice every day running 100 meters up and down. They can finish maybe 100 meters in 8.5 seconds, but not for a common man. So Patanjali says, through constant practice, this apparently supernatural powers, which are really not supernatural, can be obtained by the practitioners of yoga. All these are described in the third chapter. In the fourth chapter, Patanjali deals with liberation. So this is the structure of the work. So when we talk about samadhi, we have to deal with its earlier stages, at least briefly. When we discuss the second chapter, we will deal with them elaborately. But samadhi is the last stage, eighth stage of Patanjali system. So, see, yama, niyama, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, samadhi. That's the eighth one. So, before you reach this meditation process, you should have acquired a number of good qualities. You should have made yourself fit for that. So I shall just give a side view of some of the related parts in the second chapter. So those who have got the book can take the second chapter and come to the 29th sutra of the second chapter, which gives a list of the 8 steps: yama, niyama, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, samadhi. Yama, as I said earlier, yama includes 5 very important universal disciplines. I shall come to them again. Niyama also is a it also implies 5 important disciplines. Yama is ahimsa, satya, asteya, brahmacharya, aparigraha, non-violence, truthfulness, non-stealing, having no desire for things that do not belong to us, then purity, chastity in life, continence, and not receiving gifts. Some of these may make us wonder why potentially worried so much about not receiving gifts. Suppose you get something from somebody, what is going to happen? The Patanjali system is psychological. I shall explain this point. To give an example of why Patanjali and how he insists on this psychological aspect. Suppose you receive something from another person. You don't require it. If you go to Trader Joe's and buy something, pay money for it, not a problem. But suppose we go about receiving things from people without any discrimination, means without a discerning mind. Patanjali will tell you, Indian psychologists will tell you, that when you receive something from another person, some of his tendencies will be transferred to your account. The giver is actually the one who gains, and the receiver is the one who loses. That is just a reverse of what really happens in our life. When we go on receiving things from people, things that we may not need, we feel slowly, we gradually develop a feeling of dependence on other people. This we can easily understand psychologically. But there is a subtle process that goes behind. Patanjali says, well, suppose you receive something from a person who is a notorious criminal, whose hobby is to go about stealing things. Slowly that tendency may be transferred to you, and you are a good person, and he may slowly improve his condition. And slowly you may degenerate himself. Why this happens, we do not know. The subtle transmission line that is invisible, that very often found. In fact, that is called, that's why he uses the word aparigraha. I'm just giving one example. Ahimsa, satya, asteya, brahmacharya, I've described in the earlier classes, the first 2-3 classes. Non-violence. Why non-violence is important before we start concentration? Please don't, it doesn't mean that we should never start yoga practice before we are fully established in all these disciplines. No, that's not what Patanjali means. If you are going to Himalayas, giving up your job, giving up everything, then you can think seriously of such a step. I won't do anything, I should fully practice. But what about yoga and its relevance and implication in our times, in our life, when we have to work 13 hours a day, we have to worry about Medicare, Social Security, job security, and so on. Does it mean that we cannot practice yoga? What Patanjali means is, these ideas should be kept in mind. Once we understand that these values, ethical, moral values, are important in our further evolution in spiritual life, once we become aware of its significance, we slowly start practicing them unconsciously, by degrees, not all of a sudden, by degrees. So he makes a very important statement. For example, in the Niyama section, he speaks about Swadhyaya. I'm just connecting different sutras of Patanjali system into a coherent, relevant whole. If I go one sutra after another sutra, it may not understand the real implication. To give an example, why concentration is important and why these characteristics are important to at least an intellectual understanding of the relevance of these disciplines is important before we, while when trying to practice yoga. Patanjali speaks of swadhyaya. See, tapa santosha swadhyaya isvapanidhana. Tapa shauja santosha swadhyaya isvapanidhana. Five disciplines, niyama disciplines. He speaks of, for example, tapa is of course explained, shauja is purity explained. But swadhyaya is mentioned. Literally it means reading good books. Reading good books is as important as eating hygienic food, organic food. Eating good food, healthy food, keeps our mind and body free from sickness, at least the body. But reading good books also has an equal importance in keeping the mind pure and free from sickness. If a person constantly reads these ideas of Patanjali or any holy religious scripture and get an intellectual conviction and understanding of its relevance and then try to practice yoga, what happens is this awareness of the need to establish these disciplines, ethical values, will slowly take us forward towards more and more towards acquiring, at least to some extent, many of these characteristics. That's the idea behind it. Every action has its effect. Reading good books is also productive. Reading good books feeds the mind with good food, good thoughts. And therefore, though we may not be able to get fully established in this, constant awareness and reading and understanding and discussion of these ideas is itself a great step forward in helping us to become more and more fully established in these disciplines. In fact, recently when I went out of town, I was asked this question. That means yoga we cannot practice till you're fully established in the 10 disciplines, then I don't think anybody will buy a book on yoga. It doesn't mean that. In fact, Patanjali's commentators makes a very significant point. They say these great qualities, these great disciplines become the means for people to constantly focus on and to try to acquire more and more. And they become natural to a person who has reached the highest perfection in yoga. For a full-fledged yogi, these are natural characteristics. For the seekers, these are great ideas, great disciplines that we can slowly acquire stage by stage. So even a serious discussion and understanding of these characteristics will give a clue if we sit for meditation. We feel restless. What could be the reason? Oh, suddenly we may remember what is stated in these books. And that awareness will help us to understand the reason for our being restless. If we feel terribly shaken by a tragic event, by an unfortunate event, the moment we remember Patanjali system or any of these great ideas, we may remember, these things do not last for long. As happy events don't last long. Unhappy events also are impermanent. They also do not last long. So intellectual understanding has a great and important role to play in our spiritual evolution. That's the significance of swadhyaya. So now I will stop for the time being. We'll continue the class next Friday. So if you have questions to ask, you can ask on any general related topics. We have 10 minutes, maybe more than 10 minutes. I have just touched the one sutra today, the 17th. So I have not even started that one. So if you have no question, I will be happy to go back to the sutra. Yes. I've just touched upon one thing, that vitarka. Vitarka could mean focusing on a gross object, or also on a subtle aspect of a gross object. So I didn't go into those details, because coming before that, I wanted to throw some flashlight on the other aspects related sutras in the second chapter. So you can ask any question on this aspect.
Swami, on the idea of the tainted gift, it comes from ill-gotten gains.
The idea of?
The gift giving, you said, it comes from a source, say,
yes.
That saved money.
Yes.
And the money is from criminal activity or gambling or something.
Yes.
And you give it, say, to a good cause.
Yes.
To aid to some
place. Yes, yes.
Are they affected by that money having come from the source?
Oh, yes. The point is, when an individual receives things from such an undesirable source and uses for his own personal purpose, then slowly his mind may be affected. But at the same time, when they give for a great noble cause, what happens, you know, they will be benefited, the givers will be benefited, but it will not affect anybody. It will not adversely affect anybody. Mostly this happens in individual cases. See, Patanjali's system is essentially on the idea that spiritual progress takes place at the individual level. This is very interesting. All this should be understood in the context of a single individual. Patanjali's system is essentially psychological. How an individual, through constant practice of certain values and principles, can evolve in spiritual life. So if a person with questionable background makes a gift to a big noble cause, it would be certainly good for that person. But it will not adversely affect anybody. That's why in many of our the asamas, when people bring things, you know, we normally put in the shrine somewhere, and we cannot digest this, better go to take to God. So he has a mighty big digestive power, so he can digest everything. So we can, if the account is transferred to, if that person's evil samskaras are transferred to our account, then it will be a great problem. So better let it be transferred to God's account. He can accommodate any amount. That's very often gifts are accepted in the name of God. That's the idea, a transcendental reality. Otherwise, we cannot live in this world. You know, this principle should be understood essentially in the context of an individual's spiritual progress, the values that you should practice in his spiritual life. That's the idea behind. Patanjali doesn't speak about institutions, nations, or societies. He speaks about individuals' practice. After all, individuals alone concentrate. Samadhi is not attained by a whole group, a congregation. Samadhi is attained by a single individual. Spiritual progress is possible only for individuals. Spiritual progress cannot be obtained by 10,000 people gathering in a on a ground and pray. You know, it happens when we go to our own room, sit quiet, and meditate. Then only we become spiritual. Otherwise, it is only religion. That is a very interesting, important thing. In all this context, congregational religion is not at all implied. Spirituality and congregational religion are two entities. mutually contradictory. A whole congregation can never become spiritual. It is individuals who grow spiritually. Very often when we try to limit spirituality to a congregation or an organization or a society, there's a great danger. Social discipline, national discipline should not be interpreted as spirituality. Spirituality is essentially a matter between an individual and God. There's nobody else standing in between. So Patanjali's system is essentially based on the individual's progress in spiritual life. So any other? Again, suppose we receive something for others, we also be giving to other people. So practically, this transfer of accounts takes place both ways. We don't sit somewhere and go on acquiring undesirable tendencies from people. No, we also give our own things to others when we give. When we serve, for example, when we serve other people, when we meditate, when we help other people, then what happens, we evolve. Every single act has a sublimating, a lifting, an elevating effect in our spiritual life. So, now we will conclude and we'll continue this discussion. After this, the work defines Asamprajñata Samadhi. Two types of samadhis are described here. But while dealing with this important theme of samadhi, the two levels, Asamprajñata and Asamprajñata, the first step, the first stage of samadhi and the next stage of samadhi, it's an important topic. We will also be dealing with some of the related sutras in other chapters, which are hoped to be studied together. So, thank you. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.